I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Today, I am joined by professional sorceress and founder of Practical Occult, Alison Jacowski, as well as composer, poet, and avid translator of Greek, Corey C. Childs, both of whom have, alongside artist Adeline Soothtell, created a new translation and exegesis of the Consecration for All Purposes, PGM 4/1596-1715, which they have named The Secrets of Helios. Bringing together their skills and expertise from their various fields, they have produced a highly detailed and rigorous interpretation of this rite, which can be utilized by anyone interested in tapping into this ancient vein of power. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Alison and Corey to the Hadean Press podcast. Welcome, Alison and Corey. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Let's begin by exploring how you both personally became interested in magic.
Well, I've always been spooky. So even as a young person, I saw some things that maybe other people didn't see, including in my teen years, I had some issues with ghosts, which led me into looking into what else there is, how to handle that. And then once I realized that magic is a thing that you can get better at, I've really just thrown myself into it. I love practical magic, magic that can help solve real world problems. And I've been pursuing it for years.
My introduction to magic was kind of a strange one. I started out, I'm an artist first and foremost, and also a lover of history. And I got really excited about mythology in general. And the more time I spent with, especially cosmogonies, you know, universe birth myths, I started seeing patterns. And as I followed the expression of these patterns over time, like you see these, you see them appear in a lot of the grimoire magic, like, basically everything, like, when we talk about the zodiac and the elements, those things were born in old myths. So it was kind of a natural progression from reading these old stories and trying to utilize what these stories have in them, and then seeing how a lot of magicians got excited about that as well. So kind of naturally fell into it.
Excellent. And so for our listeners, could you describe what the Greek magical papyri are and why they're so important?
The Greek magical papyri is a selection of texts of Egyptian magic, or Heka, which we'll probably get into in a moment, that span a period of about 400 years, and they're located all over the world in different museums now. So some of them are in France, some of them are in Oslo, some of them are in the British Museum, and they've taken all of these different texts from this time period that relate to a similar subject, and scholars have classified them as the Greek magical papyri. So I know a lot of folks are used to looking at the only English translation we have out right now, which is the Betts version of it. And a lot of people think that all of those are one book that was maybe found together, but really it's a lot of little things, and it covers a long period of time after Alexander the Great rolled into Egypt and said, okay, we're going to set up shop here. All of the administration is going to be done in Greek. So it's really very Egyptian, but written in Greek. So historically speaking, scholars of Greek were the ones that were handling that.
So what personally drew you to work with these documents?
Well, for me, I heard that they were very effective magically. And as I am known for practical magic, practical occults, that's definitely something I wanted to explore. And additionally, one of their most famous spells, the Stele of Eu or the Stele of Jew, was people say that it connects you to your holy guardian angel. And I wanted to explore that and see if that was something that I could get, something that it did. So that was my first PGM spell that I looked into as a result of hearing that.
And Corey, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, the PGM, I think, was really exciting for me because when I came to it, I saw so much that I immediately resonated with. A lot of, like, my focus is mostly on Hellenic texts, and I do enjoy a lot of Hebrew texts as well. And just seeing the blend of the Hellenism and the Hebraic stuff with, of course, the Egyptian as well, seeing that hodgepodge. The first thing definitely was the hymns. I think there are 26 or so hymns scattered throughout. Most of them are either to like some form of Hecate and some form of Apollo. But those just were super, super rich and dense. And I really loved how Hecate was described too. She's awesome. She's powerful and horrifying. So that was exciting. But yeah, it's just a wonderful hodgepodge of a lot of things that I'm super interested in.
Magic in the West has been a nominally forbidden Christian, Jewish, or Muslim practice. Would you describe yourselves then as pagan?
Yes, I do. That is how I self-identify.
Yeah, I guess it kind of depends on what we mean by pagan. It does have an interesting meaning. I think, nowadays it generally means anyone who isn't like a practice, someone who's spiritual, but not following one of the major monotheisms. Do people think paganism equals polytheism? Is that usually how people approach it? Well, regardless, I think I have an interesting relationship with polytheism. I can go into it if you'd like. I would probably consider myself an emanational panentheist, maybe. Like how to say here. I view like the cosmos as like a singular organism. Like that is the one, God with a capital G or whatever. And I'm like a cell in that body. So I'm at once a part of the one, but I'm also separate from the one in a way where I can interact. And I think, we reach out to the one, and I think that the one is as interested in reaching back. There's kind of a longing for connection from both sides. And I think it's very interested in connecting with us in whatever way we like. And I think when that meeting happens, that's when I guess I would say deities are born. Like, I don't think that Hecate existed at the beginning of time. But once somebody reached out to the divine through the medium of a Hecate, the divine came as Hecate. And in that moment, Hecate was born and became an entity. So that's, I guess, how I would see pantheons. There are a lot of... there are a lot of different critters out there, but they're all extensions of one common source.
And Allison, do you have anything that you would like to elucidate upon regarding your own concept of what your paganism personally means to you?
So for me, I have direct relationships with these deities. So it's less about... it's less about what people say about them and more about what they say about themselves to me. So I work with them for both practical and somewhat devotional reasons, but mostly practical. So, usually I'm not just calling on spirits to say, hey, how are you? Or, hey, here, have this gift. Usually I'm asking them to bless me, bless my endeavors, bless other people, things like that. So my regular practice involves asking for things, but I also feel like we have a really great beneficial relationship. And it puts me a little bit apart from a lot of neo-pagans, because I don't think many of them have the two-way connection with the spirits. So they're kind of flying blind or relying on intuition or whatever they found online.
And so do you think that this magic that we find in the Greek magical papyri still has the same potency that it had back 2,000 years ago?
I think it's enormously powerful. I've done amazing things with spells from the Greek magical papyri, things that surprise even other practitioners.
I would say that if it was powerful once, it's going to still be powerful. Like it's a tool, it's a conduit, and it's a really well-made one. It's very grounded in a lot of great traditions. I think it's a great tool that's still very relevant and efficacious.
So who exactly were the people using these texts? Were they what we would call today magicians?
Probably not. So I ran across a paper from David Frankfurter called Ritual Expertise in Roman Egypt and the Problem of the Category Magician. And I think it's worth having a conversation about that. Here's a little quote about that. A small number of scholars have begun to notice that the PGM is not a random collection of spells, but an anthology of grimoires of ritual manuals. And the largest portion of this anthology is made up of a single library, the production of a single group of scribes writing in both Demotic Egyptian and Greek, which was found in Thebes and brought up in one group. In trying to understand the contexts of these spells in late antique culture, we must therefore look at the context of such ritual libraries, particularly ones found in temple cities like Thebes and written partially in languages impenetrable to the broader Greco-Egyptian populace, like Demotic and Old Coptic. So there's basically, this was not something that, just anyone was using, very likely. Very likely, these were for Egyptian lector priests. So they would be the ritual specialists in that culture at the time. And they had a diverse congregation because at the time, Egypt was really a melting pot of a lot of different folks. So that could also explain why, even though it would have been the Egyptian priests doing it, there's also a lot of Greek elements, Greek cultural elements, as well as Jewish.
So could one example of such a difference in approach be, say, the use of defixions and how common people use them, or would that be something that's still under the purview of these Egyptian priests?
So I think really there's also, when you come down to it, a mix, because we do find a lot of defixions, which are the cursed tablets that are buried in graves or thrown into wells or things like that. So there were definitely people that were doing these, but a lot of the spells in the Greek magical papyri, it's a mix. So it's a mix of what I would say the priests were doing and then what the common people were doing. Because another example would be a spell for against a scorpion sting, which is something that I've tested, and it works on scorpion stings, spider bites, bee stings, that sort of thing. But that's maybe not the sort of thing that you would go to your local priest about. That's more like first aid. So definitely there's things in there that are, things that the everyday person would use, like love spells or, curses, that sort of thing. Winning a chariot race.
Yeah, of course. And you've also got all the other factors such as, safe childbirth and raising crops, all those other daily issues that people would have been facing. So All this was happening some 2,000 years ago. Why are these documents relevant to modern practice? Is this a form of reclamation, what we're seeing, or is this a new modern syncretism?
As far as reclamation is concerned, I guess we're all kind of reclaiming stuff. With the information age, we have access to pretty much anything. You know, we don't have to join the Golden Dawn and get some random scraps that somebody has. So I think people are just resonating with it. It's there to use, and it's accessible. And also its syncretic nature means a lot of people of different walks and different traditional backgrounds can find ways to resonate with it. And it's also very straightforward too. Like, you get spells that are kind of, they're compact. It has a definite like thing you're supposed to do with it. I would say that the PGM is one of the more accessible ways to work with this stuff.
I definitely think that, you know, as a result of the information age and how much interest there is about magic on social media, and also excellent publishers like Hadean Press to help make things more accessible to folks. So in that big boom of what might be an occult renaissance, folks are looking at older material and saying, how is this relevant to later material? Like, can we go back and look at the history of things and see where, you know, how we got here? And I know that a lot of times folks kind of say that I'm one of those people that think older is better. And I just want to point out that that's not how I feel about things at all. They're not better because they're older. They're better because they work so well. So, I'm here for the results, and I'm just getting incredible results with them.
So how would you say then that somebody who's practicing a modern branch of magic today could adapt the materials found in the Greek magical papyri to their current practice?
I would say that if we're talking about people trying to take elements from other things and make it their own, one of my biggest interests really is finding like structures or just recurring patterns. Like in the spell to Helios, which, you know, we'll be talking about later, there's definitely a 12-ness going on. Like, you know, we see the like elements of the zodiac expressed, and so the modern magician can find these structures in these old spells and adapt them for their own spell work. Seeing how the four winds are used and what they're related to, you can take that structure and utilize it elsewhere. And the PGM honestly is just full of this kind of structural borrowing. So there's just a ton of pretty clear material that anyone can pick up and adapt.
The PGM is a mixed bag. So some things folks are not going to be able to adapt, and some things are more easily adaptable. So for example, if you go through the whole Greek magical papyri, you'll see things about animal sacrifice or, you know, weird components. And some of those are literal because, you know, the sacrificing of sacred animals as part of these, you know, religious/magical rituals was a thing that they did, to the point where they actually had temples where they bred animals for that purpose. So, you know, it was a different time period, and, you know, we can't adapt everything. There's spells that, you know, require a human skull. You know, that's not just something that you can go down to the street and get, even though it is potentially ethically obtainable.
Not everyone has a donkey that can sacrifice, you know?
It's true. I have been trying to focus on the spells that I think are more widely applicable. So for example, the consecration to the sun that we'll be talking about in the Secrets of Helios, I think is one of those spells that's just really good for everyone and kind of for everything. So you can do it self-targeted to bless yourself. You can consecrate an object with it. I have used it to request a familiar. There's just a lot of functionality there.
So would you say it's a generally adaptive set of documents that we could, for the most part, easily apply to today?
In some cases, in other cases, you've got spells like, take a skull of a drowned man and plant it in a field and then plant flax seeds on top of it and wait till they grow and then weave it into rope, and then it's a knot spell with that rope, and that's to find a thief. So, wow. some of these spells in here are incredibly complex, and there's easier ways to get about that. So, even if it's a historical oddity for me, that's probably not something that I'm going to try to do, because there's so many easier ways to get that result.
So it has some similarities then in nature then with, say, the Picatrix, which also has some equally as grisly and unobtainable materia and processes for relatively simple operations, which could be accomplished differently.
Yeah, in some cases there are just huge barriers to doing simple divination spells or things like that. I feel like in those cases, just keep reading. Is there another spell that's more practical, and just go to that.
Or you could just make your own, I think that's equally valid. It helps to know like the materials, but I do admire the chaos magicians, even though it helps to see what's been done, standing on the shoulders of giants and all that. If you can't afford the means, just make your own means, consecrate things yourself. Like I said, I think the divine, whatever we want to define it as, is very interested in engaging with us. So build something that you can believe in and flow through it.
And that's true. And a lot of folks do mix and match, including me. And I've written PGM style spells for my own work, and they do work, based on the principles that you find in the PGM, taking little snippets of this, little snippet of a Hecate spell here, little snippet of a call to the Ion from a different spell, mix it all up, make a request.
Oh, I was going to say, I would argue that a lot of the PGM is built that way in the first place. Like there's so much borrowing from different stories and different practices. Like these people at some point made it themselves as well, I guess bricolage, is that what they call it, where you take found elements and put things together, and thus if a person then could do it, you can as well, as long as you take your time and try to know what you're doing.
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. And personally, I've taken and adapted many sections that I've found relevant from the documents of the Greek magical papyri and adapted them to grimoire-based magic. So I think it works both ways. These texts are highly adaptive, and I think it's really important to understand their modularity, especially if you're approaching the grimoires from a pagan perspective. So this was an actual new translation of PGM 41596. So Corey, what did you actually discover, if anything? What did you learn from retranslating all of this again by yourself?
Quite a bit, honestly. I mean, first and foremost, whenever I engage any text that is in another language, and I like to engage the original language. As a poet myself, I understand there are a lot of nuances that can't really be captured in translation. So even if I wasn't asked to do this by Allison, I would have been excited and just done this anyway. As far as what I learned, I was really, really excited to see the patterns that I'm so fond of. being utilized. And you know, as far as the translation itself and me providing a new one, there are plenty of great ones out there. Not, I mean, not plenty, but there are definitely good ones. I just you know, I wanted to do something that it was something I would want to see. Basically, I have a, I guess I would call it an exegetical system I use, like the way that I analyze things, that's very object oriented, and those objects are the terms. So I strove to create a translation that very accurately expressed these terms. You know, like I tried to stick to the text as much as possible. And there are a lot of, like, you know, like, while some people will do flowery translations or, you know, put some of themselves in it, like, even beyond that, I think that word order is important too. And you'll see people kind of, because a Greek syntax can be different, they'll chop things up and move things around or just omit things. So I was really excited to try to create something that stuck to the text as much as possible, so people can do what I think should be done with it, which is look for these patterns. And I am obsessed with the Zodiac. The Zodiac is my, like, 12. I could talk about 12 all day. I adore 12. I am just smitten with it. And I use it in a lot of things I make. Like, my first opus is a love letter to the Zodiac and uses a lot of these systems in it. So yeah, it was just, I've read through the PGM a few times, and like I said, I focused on the hymns a lot. But when I started to look at more of the spells, I see the same sort of word games and, like, puzzles set up, and that's really exciting to me. So I guess I could say that this really cemented my newfound love of the PGM, and, you know, I'm definitely going to be stuck with this text, like, working with it for a while.
And so, Allison, given Corey's new translation and you turning your academic eye to the document itself, given what we've learned in recent years, is there anything that specifically jumped out at you and surprised you?
Well, one of the things I liked about it was just how joyous it is. You know, we've got the meeting place of revelers, which is Comisterion. And Corey has it as originally referring to the meeting place and processional route of the Comistai, who were drunken revelers that participated in a celebratory ritual. And that's being used as a metaphor of the sun and the stars moving in the sky. And I think that's really beautiful. And I also like how, you know, the earth flourished when the sun god laughed, which is, you know, you also see that at Esna. In the theology of Esna. So I was just, you know, I smiled at that, because meeting place of revelers is kind of a little dry, but then, you know, reading Corey's work on that just made it more joyous and celebratory. And I think that this is, you know, that's what I want. I want joy out of my rituals. I want them to be, you know, celebratory. I don't want them to be dry.
So could you describe the actual function of this operation? Why would somebody want to perform this ritual today?
Well, as I mentioned before, it's a consecration, which means to make something into a sacred object. So to impart power to it. And in this spell, one of the ways that I've used it before is to use it as a charitesian, which is a personal blessing. So it's like asking the divine to bless me specifically. So that's one way I've used it. I've also used it to enchant objects to have all of the boons listed in the spell. So the spell lists 10 different boons. Or rather, 10 of the animals have boons, like strength and honor and glory and allure and things like that. So you can give that to an object and then give that object to someone else, and they have that magic on them. you know, once it also the spell contacts the sun god. So once you have contacted the sun god with a spell, you can just freely ask for things. So I've said, hey, I've just consecrated this fancy shadow box to be a spirit home. Can you send me a familiar spirit that can help protect me against magical attacks, but also help me further learn the magic of the Greek magical papyri? So I did get that spirit from Helios, Helios Ra. The sun god goes by a lot of different names. And that was another way that I used that.
Yeah. And when I look at it, there are only some of the animals had boons directly associated with them. But when you go through the whole thing, there are arguably 12 boons specifically, like in the section that precedes the 12 hours being listed off, there are a handful. And when I was looking at these 12, you know, and that's something that's definitely interesting considering there's a 12-ness that's already inherent in the 12 animal hours. I was also looking through all of the reviews that Allison had gotten, and I started noticing a pattern where people were either talking about how it helped get them going on something, it helped them like continue going through something, or it helped them complete something. And when I looked at all the terms, I saw a sort of division where there were four that seemed associated with opportunity, like being able to initiate something that you would be successful at. There are four that seem associated with capability, like whether you are able to carry out what you had the opportunity to engage with. And then there are four that are associated with completion. So I was struck by how these 12 boons, really it's kind of wherever you're at when you're trying to accomplish an objective, like it's got you, it can get you through the whole thing. It can get you started. It can help you persist through it, and it can help you finish it. And that's something that I was really excited about.
Ah, so is that in any way related to the modern signs of the zodiac? For instance, you have the three parts of each sign, which goes cardinal, fixed, mutable?
To an extent, yeah. You know, and you can really just look at those as a beginning, middle, and end of a season. You know, if you think of the four seasons over the zodiac. And the zodiac really, it's just 12, and you can explore it through its factors. I think that's what makes 12 so nice, and that's why we're so excited about it. The structure of the boons definitely reflects like the division of like there's a 6 and a 2 and a 3 and a 4. You can see the factors layering together. I don't know how or even if they map directly onto the hours, like if there's one boon for each of the hours, considering they're kind of scattered around in an interesting way. But they at the very least are an expression of a similar structure. The zodiac structure, this 12-base structure is at the heart of the spell, I would say.
And when we talk about the these hours, are we really talking about the decans?
No, the decans are, I mean, there's 36 of those, but Allison can definitely go into the nature of the dodeca oros as it stands as a thing in itself a little better than I can.
So when I was researching the spell, there's actually two spells in the PGM that are very similar that talk about the sun. And in the first hour, you have this form of an animal, and these are the things associated with you, and these are the boons you grant. But they're totally different. So the other spell starts with a young monkey, and this was something that had really confused me and you know, definitely some of my friends before. But as I was researching this, I came across a description of a museum artifact called the Cairo Zodiac, also known as the Tabula Dorsi or the Dorsi Zodiac, after the archaeologist who found it in a market not even in a tomb. It was for sale. And it's got, it's circular, and on the inner circle, it's got all 12 animals from the spell. And on the outer circle, it has the zodiac that we're familiar with. So based on this clue, I was able to find a work by Franz Boll, who had basically reconstructed these two texts that were found in a later work that had the text of Teucer the Babylonian in them. And Teucer is the PGM era astrologer that sheds light on this. So when you ask about the decans, if you were to read Teucer's work, Teucer says about Aries, with its first decan, there arise Athena and the tail of the whale and the third part of the triangle and the cyanocephalus bearing torches and the head of the cat of the dodecaoros. So when he talks about Aries and he talks about the three decans of Aries, he talks about the cat of the dodecaoros spanning those three decans. And each one of those matches up with the start of it being Aries for the cat and going through that. So there is a direct relationship with the zodiac regarding this spell. And the other spell in the PGM starts in a different month, a different part of the year. And that is why the first hour is so different.
And why these 12 animals specifically? Are they related in some way to, say, the Egyptian pantheon?
They are, and they're also constellations.
So the Egyptian constellations, which predate the ones that we're familiar with today?
According to my current understanding, yes. So there's some astronomers who have tried to pick through the history of that and tag them to specific star clusters. I would have to, defer to their work for that.
So could either of you describe something of the cosmology that's inherent to this worldview found in these documents?
I could definitely say, part of my exegesis method is very, I look at the text itself. I try not to look at anything outside of it. So just looking at what the spell provides, I think there's one very interesting thing that we see in a lot of places where we have a day like mapped onto a year mapped onto a life, right? Like the four winds are mentioned, the four winds being also the names of the cardinal directions, and also related to and associated seasons. Through the four winds, we get a year. We see the hours and the emphasis on a day. And also we see near the end about the day setting like an old man. So we see also a life there. So there's that kind of microcosmic and macrocosmic telescoping of the same pattern playing out in several different ways.
Absolutely. And I think that also goes into the Egyptian idea of Heka. So I'm gonna lean on Jan Osman for a second here. Magic in the sense of Heka means an all-pervading coercive power comparable to the laws of nature in its coerciveness and all-pervadingness, by which in the beginning the world was made, by which it is daily maintained, and by which mankind is ruled. Magic in the sense of a particular discourse is much more specific. It refers to the exertion of the same coercive power in the personal sphere. So that's what I think is happening here. I think it's taking that that power of creation, which is mirrored in the daily journey of the sun, and it's using that force to power your magic.
And yeah, we bringing it back to the grimoires again, we see these same patterns playing out. We have these same divisions of time and focus on the cardinal directions. we see these same patterns playing out. It's clear that there's a survival of these techniques that's moving through history.
The sun god in ancient Egypt was incredibly important. And I'd like to quote a little bit from Alexander von Leeuwen. The soul of the sun permeates the whole world, sun cult and religious astronomy in ancient Egypt. She writes, from the Middle Kingdom around 1950 BC onwards, a syncretic solarizing of other gods by calling them name, Ra, is attested. This tendency increases over the course of history until every male main deity of a city or village can take on this role. Now, if you think about that in terms of syncretism, which Bonnet writes about in On Understanding Syncretism, the formula Amun-Ra does not signify that Amun is the same as Ra or that one god has merged into the other. It simply observes that Ra is in Amun, but not in such a way that both would be indissociably attached to each other and could only exist in partnership. No inhabiting is permanent. The partners can separate again and be manifest independently. So when I think about this, if you think about that and the sun moving up, you know, because the apparent motion of the sun, they, you know, folks saw that and thought the earth was still and that the sun was moving around the sky. So they looked at the apparent motion of the sun. And when the sun is in the sector of the cat, he's depicted as a cat. You see it with, you know, the cat with the knife, you know, slaying Apep. And I think that's what's going on there and why there are so many depictions of the sun god in ancient Egypt, because you see, you know, up to 72 of them in some books, or I'm sorry, 75, not 72. And that's from the Litany of the Sun, the Book of Venerating Ra in the West from 1425 BC. Lastly, for context, if we look at Iamblichus talking about the Dodecaoros on his De Mysterious Egyptorum, he asserts that the changing of form doesn't affect the sun, which is immutable, but results in different effects to the recipients. So in these, the symbolic mode of signification is shown, indicating with discourses that the sun is in configuration according to the zodiac signs and changes his form every hour. It indicates his immutable, stable, never failing, unique, collective largesse to the whole cosmos. The changes of form and configuration reside in the recipients. For this reason, they say that the sun is changing according to the zodiac sign and the hour.
So in keeping with that theme, there are multiple references to the great serpent throughout this spell. And is this another astrological concept? Who or what exactly is this god or this spirit?
So another quote again, I'm gonna lean on the Agathos Diamond in Greco-Egyptian Religion by João Pedro Feliciano. The symbolism found within seems to involve elements from the Tebtunis cosmogony, solar Egyptian theology, and presents Agatho Diamond / Helios as a ruler and vivifier of the world and its inhabitants. The earth flourished when you shone forth, the plants became fruitful when you laughed, the animals begot their young when you permitted. Later, the text draws directly on the creation myth by referencing him as the great serpent who mate in the ocean, which is an obvious reference to Peshai vivifying the primeval abyss. So that's from the Tebtunis cosmogony. So that's very Egyptian.
So what exactly is this Agathos Daimon?
So the Agathos Daimon has a bunch of different parts. A bunch of different contexts, including also as a household spirit sometimes. But in this case, we're talking about the Agathos Daimon as responsible for the generation of the earth. So, you know, I, and Agatho is just good. It's the word for good. so the good diamond. And regarding the etymology of the word diamond and its relationship to divide, I think that what this is referring to is, you know, the division of creation, because you know, you see a lot of these, you know, separated the waters, you know, separated this and that, good and evil, which you also see in the Steely Jew.
Separation in a similar way to, say, what we see in the Enuma Elish with the separation of the body of Tiamat?
I was going to say it sounds very, very demiurgic in general. I mean, that is in tons of things, even Genesis 1, definitely Enuma Elish, like where Marduk is kind of playing the Zeus role, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, so in there's another spell, PGM 1/195/222, which also references Helios, and it says, "Hear me, you who have established the mighty Decans." So that's what I think that it means by the division. I think I believe that the big version of the Agatho Diamond is related to creation as far as the division of Nun, which is the primeval abyss that has everything in it, and it's all kind of mixed up. But then it had to be separated. You know, it's this watery sameness that that required separation to generate everything else out of it. So I think that's what's going on there.
Corey, do you have anything to add about the abyss and its division and its use in magic?
That's a complicated one. I mean, it's definitely something that's present in a lot of cosmogonies. The very beginning parts is something I'm still trying to tease out and make sense of. I know talking about the abyss, like it's not something you can really look at just by itself. You have to look at what it comes with, and usually you either get four or three. Usually, I would say it's four. You've got the watery abyss. You've got like boundless, like infinite emptiness. You've got a darkness or a dark wind, and then you've got the spirit or breath. You know, you see that pretty much everywhere. My current inclination is to see them as mixtures of elements, like primordial mixtures. Like there's the Hermopolitan Ogdoad from the Hermopolitan cosmogonies, where you have pairs. Like there's Het and Hauhet. I believe that's infiniteness, or like just like infinite space / time. And it's a male and female version. So you have these four kind of overlapping pairs. And then when you look at the four, these four concepts in themselves, there's also a lot of overlap. There's not a lot of clear distinction. Like, what is the abyss? What's the darkness? Like, it's hard to wrap yourself around these things. But I lean towards thinking that they're combinations, like, you know, the powers, hot, cold, dry and wet, and how they correspond to the elements. I'm leaning in the direction that we're seeing these mixtures. So, like spirit or breath, that would probably be hot. I would say that's probably fire and air mixed together, like, from the get go. And when what you have is you have these four muddled things that come together, and they give birth to a light that ends up organizing everything very well. So yeah, I would say that abyss represents an aspect of what will be a completed, well-ordered creation in a kind of primal, like infant-like stage. It's something to be worked on as one goes about doing something, I guess.
Corey, you actually created some music to accompany this pamphlet. Could you tell us more about this music and how you accomplished this?
Yeah. I did. I did use the Cairo Zodiac pendant courtesy of Allison, while I was making everything. And I definitely think that helped. And I will also say that having to, because I made music for me to recite the spell over. And I will say that the constant reciting of the spell was a really, really intense experience. Like, I was basically doing the spell every time I did a new take. So I'm just spending, like, you know, hours in a day just doing it over and over and over again, like crackling with electricity. I think it's also funny that at the time when I was doing that, my fiance and I were talking about trying to find a house, and then we immediately found a perfect house and like everything fell into place. So that was probably helpful. But yeah, the spell just was so rich. When I was talking to you the other day about how I have a generally poetic approach to things, poetic being like related to making or crafting, you know, I just, the structures that we see utilized in this spell, like the four winds and the 12 hours, these things were really, really easy to play with. So in the music, for example, I have, there's one main theme that a soprano voice sings, but I take that theme, it plays like regular forward, then I flip it upside down. Basically, when a note would go up, it goes down instead. That's it's the inversion. I also do it backwards, that's the retrograde, and then backwards and upside down is the retrograde inversion. And I thought of those in the sense of the four winds. So there is a one that got expressed in four ways. And when you listen to the music, when it gets to the section where I'm going through each of the hours, the way that I've set things up is the first 3 hours, I have what I guess I could call the East, or the spring version of the theme. And then the next three, like, do the summer or the south, and it goes through all of them. Also, each of those seasons also has a specific percussive pattern to accompany it. Then I also have, just because the zodiac is so associated with the four elements, and there's also a heavy degree of, I guess, fourness, I would say, in the spell itself. I have like four, accompanying melodies that cycle. So like the first hour is the fire accompaniment, and the second one is the earth, and then the third is the air, and then the fourth is the water, and they kind of cycle like that. So basically I took these, the underlying structures that were in the spell, and I tried to bring the spell to life. Like if, you know, in my opinion, a lot of, like, the reason these structures are so that we're so drawn to them and we see them used so much is that there is some sort of power, like, in them. And I'm not going to say that it's just a number. You know, I do think it's, I love the Pythagorean approach, and, you know, 12 is definitely has a something to it, but the structures don't have to be just numbers. But I really tried to express what was present in the spell just musically. So the music itself is like it's an instance. It's like, it's almost like an acoustic expression of the spell. Like, if you were to say the spell without words, this is how I think it would sound.
So really, this project that you've both undergone together has been a real artistic and magical academic process, all woven together.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's been awesome. It was such a wonderful opportunity to Allison. You are a delight to work with. Like, it was, that was a really fun time.
Well, thank you both so much for sharing all of this information. I think you've given our audience a lot to think about, and I'm really sure that I'll have you both back on again in the future to continue this discussion, because it's been really interesting. Before you go, though, do you have any upcoming projects that you'd like to share with us?
Yes, I'm currently working on, fingers crossed, three more guides in the same vein. simultaneously. I'm working on all three of them. One of them is about half done. Corey has been, supplying me with translations as I need them, both of the spells and of supplementary material that may or may not make it into the guide, but that I need for the research purposes.
That sounds really interesting, Allison. We're always up for more guides to the underworld. And Corey, do you have anything coming up?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of stuff coming up. I've been on a hiatus for a bit. Some of my creative endeavors slowed down, but it's about to all whip back up here. Like Allison said, we've got some stuff that we're working on. I was also toying with the idea of us doing kind of collaborative pamphlets. We'll see if Hadian will have me. Or I can do, I have my translation, but do more of my own exegetical kind of things where I unpack it. I'm about 2/7 of the way through my next opus that's in honor of the planets. I've got the sun and moon done, but I've got 5 more to do there. I've got some courses. I'm going to try to start developing some courses for my esoteric exegesis system, maybe an introduction to Orphic literature, stuff like that. But yeah, I'm really excited. I have a ton of stuff that you're all going to be hearing a lot about.
I would like to add that folks can go to my website, which is practicalocult.com, to find additional resources about the spell, including the spell in English translation from Corey. How to pronounce the barbarous names according to the International Phonetic Alphabet, and a link to the papyri. Also, I'd like to say that for anyone who would like to read the Greek, that is in the back of The Secrets of Helios. So if you are familiar with that, you can check it out yourself. It's in the appendix. His links to his SoundCloud that has the instrumental version of the song, the Greek version of the song, and the English version of the song. So for folks who would like to have music accompanying their ritual, you can check that out and play that. Additionally, I also have, with Adeline Soothtel's illustration help, recreated the Cairo Zodiac, and it's a product that I sell on my website, Enchanted with a Spell. So if you're not the type of person who's going to do it yourself, you can always get one that I've done.
And I'll add a fun bit of trivia there. On my SoundCloud, which you can find at soundcloud.com/cccomposition, you'll see that there is an English version and a Greek version. When this was commissioned of me, when I first finished it, I presented to Allison a Greek recitation. I did the entire thing in Greek, and Allison was like, "This is great, but why is it in Greek? I have no idea how I got it wrong." But it was really, really fun to do, and I think the language sounds pretty, but I was like, you get that one for free and I'll do the English one. But that was a happy slip up right there. It had some good outcomes.
Corey, don't you also offer the opportunity for folks that would like their name inserted into the spell to do that for a fee?
Yes. For $60, basically, I will give you something where your name is in place of the what you see as NN in the translation. Yeah, and anyone who's interested in this service can for now find me on Facebook at facebook.com/CoreyTheChilds. That's THE and then my last name is CHILDS. Just shoot me a message and we can work something out.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for your time and for coming onto the show today to talk about this amazing little pamphlet. And I really look forward to seeing you both again in the future.
No, it's been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
That was Allison Chikowski and Corey C. Childs, authors of The Secrets of Helios, available now from the Guides to the Underworld series from Hadean Press. I have known Allison now for many years, and I always really enjoy her perspective and what she has to offer students of the Greek magical papyri. Corey is a really thoughtful and powerfully creative person, and I'm fascinated by his conceptualization of ritual process and by his magical application of music in his work. Both have so much more to offer the community, and I'm very much looking forward to what they have to share with all of us in the future. You can find links to their work in the description below. I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please like this video and subscribe to our channel for more like this in the future. Until then, I have been your host, Matt Hadfield, and I look forward to seeing you all in the next one.
This is the consecration of all things. Address to the sun. I call upon you, the greatest God, everlasting Lord, master of the cosmos, who is over the cosmos and under the cosmos, stout master of the sea, shining forth at dawn, from the east rising for the whole cosmos, sinking to the west. Come to me, you who rise from the four winds, the cheerful good daimon, for whom heaven has become the meeting place of revelers. I call upon your holy and great and hidden names, which you rejoice to hear. The earth sprouted afresh when you shone forth, made the plants to bear fruit when you laughed, and the animals to propagate when you permitted. Grant glory and honor and grace and fortune and capability, which I enjoin today to this stone for Corey C. Childs. I call upon you, the Great One in Heaven. Ei, Lanku, Akarain, Baal Misrain, Marta Mathoth, Lailam, Muzuti, Sietel, Batavati, Iatmon, Alei, Iabath, Abaoth, Sabaoth, Adonai, the Great God, Orsinofre, Orgiates, Tokonatesa Kriti, Diothi, Iadmo, Iatmomi, Methiei, Lanchao, Akare, Balmintre, Bonabaikukufri, Nathiusi, Thrai, Arsiuth, the brilliant sun illuminating the whole inhabited world. You are the great serpent who leads the way of those gods, who holds the origin of Egypt and the completion of the whole inhabited world, who in the ocean copulates. Soi Nuthi Ninther. You are he who becomes clearly visible during the day and sinks in the northwest of heaven, rising in the southeast. In the first hour, you have the form of a cat. Your name is Farakune. Give glory and grace to this phylactery. In the second hour, you have the form of a dog. Your name is Sufi. Give strength and honor to this phylactery, to this stone and Corey C. Childs. In the third hour, you have the form of a snake. Your name is Amakanabekeo Thou. Give honor to the god. In the fourth hour, you have the form of a scarab beetle. Your name is Senthenes. Join in supporting this phylactery in this night for the reason that it is initiated. In the fifth hour, you have the form of a donkey. Your name is Infam Kuz. Give strength and courage and capability to the god. In the sixth hour, you have the form of a lion. Your name is Bai Soldai, the ruler of time. Give advantage to this phylactery and beautiful victory. In the seventh hour, you have the form of a goat. Your name is Miss Loth. Give allure to this signet ring. In the eighth hour, you have the form of a bull. Your name is Diative, who becomes light-giving. Fulfill it all through the use of this stone. In the ninth hour, you have the form of a falcon. Your name is Feuz Foyu, the lotus brought forth out of the abyss. Give advantage and good opportunity to this phylactery. In the tenth hour, you have the form of a baboon. Your name is Bezuki. In the 11th hour, you have the form of an ibis. Your name is Mugo. Fulfill the great phylactery for the good of Corisi Childs from today into all time. In the 12th hour, you have the form of a crocodile. Your name is Arentare. You sink after a long time, late in the day as an old man. You, who is over the cosmos and under the cosmos, stout master of the sea, hear my voice today, in this night, in these sacred hours. And let all fulfill through this stone, through this phylactery, the prescribed purpose for which I initiate this. Verily, Lord Kemeth, Luthiuth, Orfoike, Ortlebehuk, Dierke, Rum Eperetau, Luai. I adjure the earth and heaven and light and darkness and the all-founding great god Sarus. You, the good daimon who is beside me, fulfill all for me through the use of this signet ring or stone. When you complete the initiation, say, One Zeus is Sarapis.